Welcome to Clearly Quaker, an ongoing series of podcasts by Salem Quarterly Meeting, part of the Religious Society of Friends. Salem Quarterly Meeting is an association of seven Southern New Jersey Quaker meetings within Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. Priscilla Adams, who works for Catholic Charities based in Camden, is a member of Haddonfield Monthly Meeting. She discussed refugee resettlement programs of Catholic Charities in South Jersey before meeting for worship at Woodstown Monthly Meeting on February 26th.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to visit this meeting and other meetings. It's just so wonderful to share our Quaker spirit in different locations and meet with friends, so thank you. It's my privilege to work with the Refugee Program of Catholic Charities. Our office is in Camden. It's right on Haddon Avenue between Route 130 and Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital, so it has easy access. And this program has been going for many years. We resettle a little over 100 people a year. We count as people rather than families because some of our families are one person and some are nine people. So if we said two families and it was 10 people, it wouldn't give as clear an image of our resettlement process. And I gave everyone a handout so you can see this is what resettlement looks like. Our biggest population that have been here a little longer are Burmese people. There are many different ethnicities and languages in Burma or Myanmar, and that's one of our largest populations. And then the past year, we've had many, many people come from Syria. Most of our new families have been from Syria. But we have people from many other places, too. Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea. We have one family from Colombia, a number of individuals from Cuba, Pakistan, so many different places. But the biggest populations are those two, especially Burmese and Syrian families. And my job is the most wonderful in the agency because we're a very small program and we divide by task. So my task, rather than having one family and doing everything with that family, I work with all the families on schools. And schools are by far the most positive thing for a refugee family in their life because other things are very difficult. Housing is difficult and work is difficult. And school isn't easy. It's very hard for the children, but it's a very joyful thing. So I work in the most joyful area of the program, and that's wonderful. Plus, as you can imagine, children bring joy to everybody. So as you can see on that sheet, refugees, we get only a few weeks' notice that a refugee family is coming. It can be as little, sometimes it's as little as 1 week, or it can be maybe 4 weeks, but we don't know very far in advance. And when they come, we need to have a place ready for them to move into. So depending on the size of the family and their any physical issues. So we have a place ready. We pick them up at the airport, make sure they have a hot meal that first night that they're there. Almost everyone comes in at night by the time the plane gets in and then they get to Philadelphia. And then we visit them all the time. We have some regulated visits, like we have to be there within 24 hours, but in reality, when a family's new, they see us all the time. Our biggest period of help is in the first 90 days, when it's most intensive, because they have to apply for Social Security cards, for Medicaid, for food stamps, for all those things, and the children need to be registered for school. So there's many things that happen in those first 90 days, and the government thinks they should be self-sufficient in 90 days, which they are more self-sufficient, but no family is totally self-sufficient in 90 days. Most of our families come with very little English. It's rare that a family has much English. Some have none at all. Some come from, have had school in the past. Some have had no school. But almost every child is what's called in educational circles a SIFE, which means a student with interrupted formal education. So some of our children, for example, might be high school age, but have only read at a third grade level in their own language. So there can be huge gaps in education. So it's very challenging, to say the least, for the students. And I am continually inspired, and just, I really respect the families who come, because they're coming for safety and to provide a better life for the parents and the children. But it's something I would hate to do. I would hate to go to another country where I knew nothing about the culture, couldn't speak the language, and just think how hard it is even for us to get dentist appointments or doctor appointments or to fill out the papers for food stamps, any of these things. They're complex if you're from the United States, and if you don't speak the language and they're interpreting, it's, so life is a struggle. The federal government gives a little bit of money per person when a family arrives, but it's a little money, and they have to use that to pay the security deposit, the rent, all those things. So all families have to have someone start work as soon as possible. Often this is the father, and often it's a place like Walmart at night, because Walmart is willing to hire people, but it's a very difficult situation. You've been through all this trauma, and you get here, and then you're working at night, and it disrupts your biological clock. But doing that, they can stock shelves, which requires much less English than most jobs. Walmart also doesn't, they call it full-time, but it's not full-time, so it doesn't pay all the bills. So there's many different issues. I want to make sure to say that all of the families that come to us have refugee status already, which means the United Nations High Commission on Refugees has been through a long process. The average is about 2 years. Some families, it's much, much longer. But they've been through a long process to be approved as refugees, which means they are certified by the United Nations that they are fleeing for fear for their lives, that they have faced persecution. Some it's already happened to, some are trying to get out before something terrible happens to their family. But they all have refugee status, which means they do qualify for the services in the United States immediately. However, as we all know, bureaucracies don't always go smoothly. So sometimes we can apply for food stamps and it takes months to get it. To work here, they all qualify to be able to work here because of their refugee status, but you have to have the right, you have to have your Social Security card, and sometimes you get it fast, and sometimes it's a long time, or so there's many complexities to their lives, but they all try so hard, and they're, as I said, it's a privilege to work with them. I say with the children, there's two big hurdles for them. One is, good morning. One is when they first arrive here and they speak so little English. And then the next hurdle for the students in school is when they know much more English and they test out of ESL. Unfortunately, there's a push from the government to move children out of ESL as quickly as possible, which means that they don't have that much English before suddenly they test out of ESL, and then there's not as much support for them in the school. So they go from a more supportive environment with ESL class, English as a second language classes, and having much of their work modified because this isn't their first language, to suddenly they have to write much longer papers and read long books. So those are two big hurdles for children, and it's a very, it's difficult for them, but it's also difficult for someone like me to see the children who are doing so well in English then suddenly hit this wall where they're expected to do many of the things that U.S. students who have always spoken English do. And to see them, you know, be stars in their schools, and then suddenly now they're, you know, heading back down again, no fault of their own. It's really a wonderful thing, and there's an endless variety of opportunities for people who would like to volunteer with Catholic Charities. We have a lot of things already in place which people can participate in, but we're open to any new ideas. So if there was something that someone really wanted to teach or to do or something, we'd love to talk with you, or you can plug into the things that already exist. There's also always opportunities for things which you can do from your own homes or your local areas. For example, we'd love to have more people looking for affordable housing, because to find a place for a refugee family to live, it's very difficult if you're a single person, and you get, the government gives $1,125, which if you think security deposit and first month's rent, so to find an affordable place for a single person is very difficult. And to find an affordable place, our biggest families are 9, which means by law they have to have a certain number of bedrooms and space, and to find an affordable place for a family of 9. And of course, everywhere in between, but the two, the largest and the smallest, are the most difficult. So anyone who would like to help us look for affordable housing or talk to potential employers, we always would love to have supportive, kind employers who would take people in and help them with a job. We have English as a second language free in our office, so we always can use volunteers with that. We need people who would like to drive people to appointments. We do various, I do a range of family programs, which includes some educational part, some fun part, and we always give away things, whatever donations we have at that time. So people who would help us with those. But as I say, there's so many other opportunities. Some families have children with special needs, and if people wanted to help those families with the special needs, and how do you approach that in the United States? It's an endless array. We love volunteers. There's also a number of things that other that religious groups and Quaker meetings have done, which are not technically part of Catholic Charities, but which help the families. So, for example, one Quaker meeting had a summer camp, a summer peace camp at their meeting, and they didn't have a good registration in the beginning, so I called them up and said, well, how about some refugee students? And they, I think we registered 12, although one child got sick and couldn't go. So they took a large number of our refugee students, and the children asked me endlessly, why does this have to end? Can I go next year? Can I stay all summer? To be, you know, many of these children spoke very little English, but it was a peace in the environment camp. They loved it to, you know, interact with kids from the U.S., to have loving, supportive adults helping them do things, and to get out, because our families get very isolated. Especially during the summer when there's no school, a lot of children are basically trapped at home because they don't have funds to do fancy things, and certainly not to pay for camps or those kinds of things. So that's one example of Friends Meeting who actually had a camp already in place and took in our students. Another Friends Meeting gave us scholarships last year to send two children to the Quaker camp Darkwaters. And they loved that, and so did the camp, because it's a mutual wonderful opportunity that it broadened the camp, and the children just loved it so much. So that's another idea. Certainly many places collect donations for us. They have special drives to collect blankets or household goods or diapers or all those, any of those types of things. So that's a thing that a group can do without being technically a volunteer, where you have to fill out paperwork. And then, of course, Haddonfield Meeting has the Refugee Assistance Fund, which helps people with needs that aren't covered by those other things. As I said, all the families have to have someone working, but if you suddenly hit winter and the electric bill skyrockets, or one family, the neighbors came over to play and a window got broken, but neither of those refugee families had the money to fix the window. We had one person, a woman who was crossing the street, walking across the street, and a car hit her. So not only did she end up in the hospital, although thankfully, miraculously, she wasn't badly hurt, but in the midst of going to the hospital, no one watched for her purse, so she lost her purse with all her ID and some money in it. So there's various ways that the Refugee Assistance Fund has helped people, all of which are... There's an endless array also of needs, very legitimate needs. We can't possibly cover all of them, but we can help in all those small ways. And every time that someone reaches out to the refugee families, whether it's to visit or to donate something or anything like that. It's such a gift because it's such an act of caring and of faith and showing you're valuable. As you can imagine, with all the things going on with the government, there's a lot more fear among the refugee community now. There's fear for themselves who are here, tremendous fear for their families, who many of them hope to bring family members here and no idea whether they'll get in or not. So on the government level, the news has been very bad recently. Thank goodness for the courts, because we had refugee families scheduled who all got stopped and weren't allowed in. One of those families just arrived, thank goodness, but in between when the banned and stopped families and when they got in, they were rescheduled. I can't even count how many times. Oh, it's going to be this day, no that day, no this time, no that time. Thankfully, they're finally here. So on that level, the news has been very difficult for families and for our program. On the community and people level, it's been very good because we've gotten many more calls from people saying, I want to do something, I want to help, and that's been wonderful. So we have more volunteers than before. We've had more donations than before. So all of that's wonderful. So it's a very interesting dichotomy between the governmental level and the people-to-people level. I'm trying to keep my eye on the clock because I want to make sure that you all have time to ask any questions, either from that sheet or any type of questions that you'd like to ask. I want to give a few examples of the children since that's the part that I do most with and I love. I love every part, but so the very first child that I enrolled in school was a young man, probably he was either 7 or 8. He was Burmese, and so we filled out the 10 tons of paper that you have to fill out to go to school, just a huge amount of paper. We got him all registered, and his father, an interpreter, and I took him to school the first day. And they were so excited to go to school, and I took him, and then I thought, what in the world is going to happen to this young man? Because here he is in a school, no one in his class spoke his language. He spoke no English. He couldn't say, bathroom, I'm hungry. He had no idea how to get to his parents or, he wouldn't be able to say where he lived. He would have no phone number, nothing like that. And I left him there. And I am a very protective mother. So I was so stressed the entire day. And at the end of the day, I said to the interpreter, call right away. He's home. Call. Tell me what happened. And he came home as happy as can be. Because now he's elementary school. Elementary school in particular is so warm and loving. And so for him to be with other children and that whole environment and to learn, he was so happy. So that was my first learning experience, to go from such stress to, oh, thank goodness. Now, every child, though, does go through rough times because there's lots of things they don't know about the U.S. Some come from very rural places and don't know about school bathrooms. How do you use those things in the bathrooms? The food is unrecognizable. Certainly all the Muslims have things they won't eat, primarily pork, but some Muslims go vegetarian because the other meat isn't halal. The Burmese have fewer food restrictions, but still, if you look at U.S. food already cooked and you're from another place, there's no telling what it is. So all of our children qualify for the free school lunch, so they all get free breakfast and lunch, but again, not knowing what it is, and it's very, very different from the food that any of our families are used to. So that's another hurdle, but that's a hurdle, you know, to figure out the food, but also to figure out, again, those things like the bathrooms or the Arabic-speaking families feel like if the child doesn't want to go to school this particular day, that's okay, they don't. Whereas the United States says, no, once you've registered, you need to be there, and you only have a few unexcused absences. So I get calls about that all the time. You know, this child hasn't been here, why? So there's just lots and lots of things to learn. In my very, it's all still a limited experience. Most children go through a silly stage, especially boys, where, you know, they can't speak the language. It's difficult to play sometimes with other children because they don't know the rules and they can't understand what the rules are without language. So they'll do goofy things because then other people interact with them in that goofy way. So there's often a goofy stage. But many, many, many of the children go from it being so difficult to being just stars in their schools that other people love them. There's one little girl where when I went to a parent-teacher conference, the teacher said that other parents came to parent-teacher conferences and said, "We are so happy she's in the class. She has taught our children. She's in third grade. She's taught our children so much about people, and we're just so happy she's in the class. She has really made a difference in our child's life." So that's another example. A huge, huge hurdle is when children have special needs and they come with very little English, because it's very difficult for the schools to assess them. There are definitely no certified interpreters for a child study team or other special needs in Burmese. There are none. Burma, although is a relatively small country, it has over 130 different languages. These aren't accents like, you know, the South and the North and the U.S. These are different languages. So unless they speak the most common language, Burmese, they can't talk to each other even. So and some of the families are ethnic groups that speak very little Burmese. So that makes it even more difficult. Some of our families, for example, the interpreters will say, "Well, I think they understand maybe 50% of what I'm saying." Mm-hmm. So they do some, but they try so hard. And we do have a number of children, as with any population, has children who do have learning issues and need special services in schools. And as I say, it sometimes gets quite delayed. Some schools will be more supportive of the idea of a child study team, and some say, no, it's just they have to be here long enough to learn more English. But if the learning disability means you can't learn English, it's a horrible spiral. There was one family who I know three of the children, in my opinion, who, and I'm not trained, but to me it looked like they all had the same learning issue, that they tried, they were caring, but there was a seventh grader and a high school senior, neither of whom could read beyond a first grade level, and they couldn't remember things like sun and all those types of things. So they had pretty severe learning issues, but very sweet children and tried. They really tried. And at that point, the state was our supervising agency. The state is no longer our supervising agency because Christy pulled out of refugee services, which actually for me was a wonderful thing because they were sometimes very hostile to our refugees. I don't know why they worked in that section. But they sent me to the house of this family with the three children, and they said, "We want you to go out and talk to them and see, do they want to learn?" Which immediately inflamed me. So I went out and I tried to think of some questions I could ask to show the state. One of the questions I asked the seventh grader, I said, well, I asked both the seventh grader and the high schooler, but the high schooler was way more reticent than the seventh grader. So this is a child, he's in seventh grade, he was there, he had been there maybe 4 years and was still at a first grade level and not able to answer questions about sun and months and things like that. And I said, well, what are your goals for school? You know, now this is a middle school boy, so I thought, who knows what he's going to say, but I can at least report that back to the state. And he said in his language through the interpreter, he said, "My goal is to speak English perfectly." So that was an amazing moment to me, that this child who is, you know, for me, I would be really depressed if I had struggled for years and still couldn't do this. And that's pretty much where I am with language. The Arabic families all try and teach me, and it's hopeless. But so here is this beautiful child who the state still continued to say, well, we don't think he doesn't want to learn, which infuriated me even more, but we did get him into a child study program, which helped him. So as you can tell, I could go on and on and on. I love my job. The families are, as I say, remarkable and inspirational. So much courage and strength and so much caring that they're always so hospitable. It's very difficult to try to just give a paper or a donation to an Arabic or a Burmese family and then just walk away because they'll come on in. We want you to have coffee. We want you to have tea. We even though they have so little and they don't have enough money for their daily needs, they still want to give to us. So what questions do you have?
I'm wondering if you could tell us a little more generally about what Catholic Charities does on a national level, the scope of the work that Catholic Charities does.
Catholic Charities is very large, and it has offices all over the country, and each area does different things. So in our office in Camden, it's a large building with many staff, but there's only a few refugee staff. My dream is that somehow there will be more money to hire more people because we run constantly, and still there's so many things that we can't do because we just don't have enough people. The bulk of the people in our building work with welfare programs. We also have a veterans program. We have some prison ministries. In our office, there's quite a few financial people who help with the budgets and do all those sorts of things. So the bulk of the staff in our building are not the refugee program. And it's similar in other parts of the, and there's offices throughout South Jersey that are part of Catholic Charities. Most of them focus on local poverty issues, food pantries, welfare issues, work issues, and the veterans program is in many different places. And on a national basis, it's similar that each area has different focuses. They are, from what I've heard, trying to start a refugee program in the north part of New Jersey. I don't know the status of it. As far as refugee resettlement in New Jersey, in the north, it's the International Rescue Committee and Church World Service. They're like around Elizabeth in that area. And in the whole entire south, it's Catholic Charities from Camden. So we can resettle refugees in any county. We have a couple families in Trenton, but mostly it's Burlington County a little bit, and primarily Camden County and a few to the south. Because of family ties, this leads into other things, sorry. We don't resettle refugees in Camden because the level of violence there and the bullying in the schools and issues like that. So we don't resettle any refugees in Camden City itself. We do the small towns and primarily up and down the White Horse Pike because there's a bus that goes there. So there is some access for those families to get places. Our biggest populations are in Woodland and Summerdale, but we have refugees in Oakland, Haddon Township, Audubon, Stratford, and then branching out some, Belmar, Pensauken, Cherry Hill, Morristown. And our farthest families are in Vineland, and that's because they already had family there, so they moved in with family who have been here a long time and thankfully are fluent in English because it's a hike to get to Vineland. We do a variety of things with Catholic Charities. I don't know if that was detailed enough for you.
What about health issues? Because I know in the past we sponsored family, a little girl had TB that she picked up at a camp. So as the nurse, I ended up being overseeing the health issues, and we got her on the medicine right away, and she was accepted in school and all. But that's only one out of the hundreds, I'm sure. But is there some overseeing of the families as they come in for, you know, their health situation? Because did the kids get their immunizations? You know, there's such a huge area of that. I mean, our kids are, you know, from the time they're, 2 months old, all the way into their teens for boosters and all that. I'm sure that that's something that's addressed by your group somehow.
Yes. And we've seen somewhat of a change with that. So the answer is yes, that all the families need some health services, and that's one of the first things we do. So when a refugee family arrives, we take them to social services immediately so they can get the paper saying they have Medicaid for the first, although they have it, we need that paper that says they have Medicaid immediately, emergency Medicaid, and then we wait for their cards to come. But as soon as we get that letter, we have take them to health centers. Because of the system of being a refugee resettlement, we can only use one health center. It's called the federally approved QHC, federally qualified health center, something like that. And it has been, for as long as I've been here, South Jersey Family Medical Center in Hamilton. So every single one of our refugees has to be taken all the way to Hamilton, which absorbs a huge amount of staff time. And we, as I say, we resettle a little over 100 people a year, but when at the end of the last fiscal year, the U.S. had not taken in as many, this is when Obama was still in office, had not taken in as many people as they thought, so they brought a lot of people in at the end of the year. So in 3 months, we got 84 people out of the 100 that's supposed to be the whole year. So that created a huge nightmare with everything, but especially the health services, because a child can't get into school without the school physical and the first immunizations. They can't get caught up before they start, but they have to have some. So that delayed the school entry by months while we tried to get all these kids through this process. So the each ethnic group does have somewhat different health issues. So a population like the Iraqis have many fewer health issues. Most of those people coming in have been healthier, not that they don't have any, but overall generally healthier. Burmese people had much less access to medical care, and we have a lot of Burmese clients who have to go for serious dental work because they didn't have dental care. So children and adults who need teeth pulled out and things like that. I think there's only maybe one or two maximum children who didn't need shots. They all need shots. So we have to work on that. Now, with the Syrian population, we're starting to get more people with serious war injuries. So this makes life much more difficult and makes that housing piece, the more help we can get with housing, the better. So, for example, our most recent Syrian family, the father has war injuries and needs a first floor apartment. So now we not only need it to be affordable and somewhat close to our office because this family has a lot of needs, it has to be a first floor. So that family has three young children, one of whom, the oldest of which, has some sort of learning mental issues and physical issues. So another reason they need a first floor. So there are a lot. So the medical issues, depending on which refugees, where they're coming from and how directly they've been in war and things like that, it changes it dramatically. So we are getting a lot more people with war injuries. Who need, you know, we now have two men who, one was shot in the jaw and one was hit with a rifle butt, both of whom need big reconstructive surgery to. Occasionally we get people with mental illness, and so then that's another whole thing. That's really hard too, because there's not many psychiatrists that will take new patients and very few who will take Medicaid, and so that's a very difficult situation, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of stress from war. That's what our previous doctor, his specialty was the trauma of war on children. And that certainly must come through, even you know, with so many.
Yeah. And it's because of the language, it is very difficult to, like we, Catholic Charities, one of the other programs in our office is a counseling service, which will see any of our families. But it's tricky because you know, the language and the security issues. And some of the families are very caring towards us, but they've been in situations where you can't trust your neighbor. So it's an interesting blend of they're very caring, but sometimes, for example, we'll say, okay, well, If your food stamps didn't come, we don't have a magic wand. We have to turn in these papers and we have to wait, and they won't believe us. So, you know, because they think that we should be able to make these things work. Or and sometimes the people from the same country get along really well, and sometimes they have huge conflicts, either because they're from a different ethnic group, or sometimes it's a different level of education and sophistication. And sometimes it's, so it can be lots of different, and sometimes it's just not trusting. And this is even within families, that, you know, we can have people from the same family, and sometimes they really help each other, and then other times they'll, you know, say, no, I don't want to do that with that, you know, member of my family.
I would imagine that a family, or perhaps a head of household, that initiates the process to get involved in the refugee program is a particular kind of person. In other words, these refugees aren't necessarily just plucked off the street. They have to be very much motivated to seek out help and go through that very arduous process. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how much you get to learn in your work about the backstories of the families that you get to work with, and how that plays into the kind of care you provide for them.
Mm-hmm. When I... our program director has changed in the time that I've been there, and with the previous program director, so we're always learning and growing and trying new things. So the previous program director, I never heard anything about the past. It was all focused on, you know, let's help them right here and now. But with this program director, we're hearing more about the past, and some may also be the change in where people are coming from. I do things like I invite the English as a second language teachers from all the schools to come to our office to meet each other, because that's so helpful for, you know, a teacher who has had refugee students for a long time, and someone who's brand new, they can talk to each other, or if they are both new but see if they have similar issues. And one of the things that the ESL teachers have asked for is more background information, because that really affects the school. And, you know, is the child going to be traumatized by loud noises, or, you know, things like that? How much has the child seen, or how much of has the family been able to shield them somehow? So now we're starting to learn more of that, I think, for those two reasons, that I now ask each family when I'm registering them for school, I have a list of questions that includes those types of questions. And I think also because the families, the combination of the medical and the trauma that we're hearing more about, well, I need to see a dentist because I was shot or something like that. We get a little information about the families ahead of time, but it's usually very little and may or may not have any accuracy. An example being, we once got a refugee who they said, oh, this person's in great health. He was older. I'm not sure how old, maybe 60s, I'm not sure. I don't think old enough to be 65 and get those services. But they said, oh, you know, this person's fine. And he came in, and within the first month, he had both his legs amputated. So it was like, what? So there's many surprises. And yeah. And we do... You know, those things about the children are important. When we took one of the Syrian families to visit the school, these kids really wanted to go to school, and it's a school that has a police officer in the school who, like, she does crossing guard duty, and, you know, she's very friendly. She does have a gun, though. The interpreter said, that's going to be really hard for these children, because when they were trying to leave, they saw the people come and almost kill their father and hit him with the rifle, and, you know, they're very scared of the police. And so we immediately, when we went to turn in the registration papers and gave them a tour, we invited the police officer to come. And also, I'm very glad she's a female, because I think that's less scary. So she came, and she was very smiley, and then later, the student said to the interpreter, "Oh, the police are different here, aren't they?" And you know, so he could see that it's, but those things are still scary. And many of our, especially Arabic male students of any age, but especially the little ones, you know, part of education is to correct someone, you know, this is your place in line, or, you know, this answer, you need to do it a little differently. And they're very sensitive, this is, in my opinion, a cultural thing, to correction. Even as sweet as those ESL and other teachers are, and they might just stop interacting for a while, and, you know, because they're not. So there's many, many cultural things. The Arabic students have a really difficult time, like high school students. One mother said to me, oh, my daughter saw two students kissing at school. We don't ever want her to go back. So there's a lot of cultural things that, and just the other day I was out with and saw a family on the street who said, we were coming to get you. And this is an eighth grade boy, very new to the country, Syrian. The family is more educated than others, and very, very sweet, but also their faith is very important to them. And he's in eighth grade. He speaks a little more English than most, and in my opinion, he's very handsome. He's very personable, and apparently a female student in the middle school came up to him and said, I love you. And he came home super angry. This person said this to me. What? So there's just many interesting. That one is thankfully not something that's bullying or something like that. We have had children bullied. The Muslim young women who wear the hijab scarf, we've had issues with that. We've had a family who's been here quite a while had neighbor children come to there. The boys were playing outside, had neighbor children come and start a fist fight with them. And so there are definitely issues for many of the families, but thankfully less than I would probably think could happen.
Do schools have any programs in advance of children coming in so that they could say, you know, this little child from another culture is coming and there's going to be, you know, might be some issues and we're hoping you can help them, you know, to kind of, you know, ward it off before it starts, so to speak, or to, you know, that they'll be able to treat them more kindly. Is there anything like that in advance? You know, being proactive is often very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Most of the schools where we resettle families have a interesting and perhaps surprising number of students that don't speak English or that come from another country. Woodland has a lot of Spanish-speaking students. Summerdale has now had Burmese students for many years, so they're the new districts, like this was our first family that we resettled in Cherry Hill. Cherry Hill has a lot of students from other places. So most schools have that. However, the children who were afraid of the police, they're in East Hampton, and East Hampton Elementary School had three ESL students before we brought our family with three ESL students. So we doubled their population, and this is a whole new world for them. The other ESL students are Spanish speaking, and I don't know where they're from or anything about them, but I don't think it's anything like the situation with these children who have been traumatized trying to get out of Syria. So. And in a school like that, it can go either way. It can go that they get very little attention because the school isn't set up, or that they get a lot of attention because the needs are great. And thankfully, East Hampton is a lot of attention. We also have, sitting next to me is the staff person. She's a Vista AmeriCorps volunteer, and she coordinates all volunteers and donations. And she now is also part of a program called I Am New Here, and it's somehow through Vista and AmeriCorps, but I don't know how. So she has a book, a picture book, that she goes into schools and works with individual classes and reads the book and does activities talking with the children about how do you welcome a refugee student or any student that's new. And so that's been very well received. Mm-hmm.
So Priscilla, thank you for the wonderful, wonderful work that you're doing and have been doing. You've been a model for all of us in South Jersey of pass on, who really puts her heart into everything that she's doing. When you think of priorities in terms of things that, for example, our meeting could think about doing, and I know that the needs are so great and the breadth of needs is so great, but what would you say to a meeting in terms of our responding in terms of priorities? What can we most do? What can we do that would be most helpful, I guess is what I'm asking.
That's difficult for me to answer because as soon as I say one thing, then my head goes, oh, well, what about this?
Really?
So I think what I would say is to follow your leadings and see what makes sense for you. I would love to have way more people who would come to our office, fill out the paperwork, and come and be there to help with things like the application for, if you get free and reduced lunch at school, you can get internet from Comcast for $10. And this brings a whole, you know, it lets kids do schoolwork at home. It lets, you know, they can watch TV, although not many watch Sesame Street, which is what I would like. But there's so many papers, or, you know, if they need an appointment, or if they, you know, some agency says, well, you haven't turned in this paper. So if we had more people who wanted to come and do those kinds of things, that would be awesome. So that's one area of priority, or any other type of volunteer thing would be, you know, if someone wanted to work with an individual family, or like I always have things that I could use help with. Just to give you an example is there's a little girl who, she's 9 and she had a really terrible medical diagnosis, and now she's gotten one that's, they said, oh no, that wasn't right, and they've given her a way worse diagnosis. So she needs to, actually it starts tomorrow, she gets therapy in the school, but she needs to go to Wiseman Children's twice a week, and she's going to get 4 therapies, occupational, physical, speech, and feeding. So the family has no car and there's no buses. So the choice is put her on a medical transport system like LogistiCare or arrange rides for her. And I'm going with the arrange rides for her because LogistiCare, although it's good that it exists, it's a very problematic system because this family has used it before and waited 4 hours and they never came to get them. So, and this little girl is way too frail. We can't, I refuse to let them, she can't go that long. So, so there's individual things like that that people can do, or, you know, any of the things in our office or the programs. We always need things like, diapers, or, you know, there's a big long list, household, new and gently used household items, or body soap, or all those kinds of things. We always can use donations for places that are closer to us. I dream of, like, congregations inviting refugees to do things, like whether it's, let's all have a summer picnic, and we'll play games outside, and, you know, so it could be things like that. So I would say everything is a priority, and that doesn't help, but I think it has to be you all weighing what is a way that you would like to help that you feel led to do and that is doable given where you are and what, you know, time you do or don't have and what resources you have, those kinds of things.
What are the requirements for the folks who volunteer in
No requirements. We have a certified ESL teacher, so he teaches a lesson and then he divides up students with volunteers, so you don't have to have any training or anything like that. We also have started sending people out to homes because there's a lot of, particularly like a mom with young children can't get there for ESL often, so we've been sending people out to homes to talk and do things, and a lot of families, you know, like some towns are very small and the family can know here's a park and I can walk to it, but the bigger towns, families might not know how do you get to a park and what, you know, what are the parks like for the children. So there's a lot of individual things that can be done. So the biggest areas would be volunteers, donations of goods or money or any of those other types of things that a congregation might want to do. If you wanted to maybe approach a meeting that's closer and say, oh, would you like to do a summer festival? You know, you're closer, it'd be easier to get families there. Transportation, help with that, looking for housing or looking for jobs. I think that's pretty much I've listed. We can use help with everything. Certainly if anyone speaks Arabic or Burmese, they're extremely difficult to learn. And for those of you who don't, I don't know if you know, but both Arabic and Burmese do not use ABCD. So these families are not just learning a new language. They have to learn the alphabet. Arabic, you read it the opposite way from us, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of other things. Both Arabic to me does look like art, but also Burmese is like all these beautiful circles, mm-hmm. And I just look at, oh, that's a nice pattern, but would I ever be able to read it? No, never. Mm-hmm. Every time someone is just kind to a refugee, it means so much because it's hard to describe, but it's hard for them to get to know their neighbors because many of them don't speak the language, and we also drill into them things like, if you don't know the person at the front door, don't open the door, especially don't children open the door for strangers ever, you know. So we say some of those things over and over, and we have had issues with one particular group of Jehovah's Witnesses in one town were really going to the refugees, and they were taking the children off without their parents, so we do have issues like that. And we also have issues with landlords that in order to find the cheapest places, some of the landlords are kind and they're cheap because they care, and some are cheap because they're slumlords. Mm-hmm. And they try to, they won't take care of things, like if the apartments have bugs, or they'll say, one family had the inexpensive plastic blinds and they had a leak. And this is a family with a special needs child. This leak went on, despite our efforts and the family's effort, for months, and the walls all black from this stuff leaking in. So they came in yet again to look at this leak and paint it instead of fix it. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, the blinds are broken, and the landlord put in blinds and charged them $100 a window. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for blinds you can get in Walmart for $6. Under, yeah. So we always need advocates for people in an endless number of areas. And but the families are in that building because it's cheap, mm-hmm. And right now there are a lot of Burmese families there, and they like being together because then, you know, if one's going out, they can say, watch my kids, or they can walk to the school.
Thank you for listening to Clearly Quaker. We hope you have found this podcast thought-provoking. If you have questions or comments, or would like to learn more about South Jersey Quakers, reach us at salemquarter.net.